But again, I wanted to start with a recap of where we've been in Romans so far so that it kind of sets the stage for that. Because starting next week, the focus shifts pretty dramatically in the book of Romans. So to start with the very first paragraph, I'm afraid that the first blank is the longest one you'll have to fill in the whole thing. When I was filling in the blanks, I realized I didn't leave enough room. So just do what you have to write really small or something to fill it in. So this is Paul's main point is this, that in the gospel, God's faithfulness to his covenant promise, and if you can cross out the S, it shouldn't be plural, God's faithfulness to his covenant promise, which is this, to reconcile all creation to himself through Israel. And we've got it up there. That's the basics of what his covenant promise was from the very beginning to Israel. To reconcile all creation to himself through Israel. So it's in the gospel that God's covenant faithfulness to his, God's faithfulness to his covenant promise is revealed. This is not just a story for Jews, but it is a story for all people. And yet the gospel is not just a story. It's not just some kind of interesting thing out there. It is also the power of God. It's the power of God to what? To save all people from sin and death. So that's his main point. And then he unpacks it. The first 8 chapters are very much about him unpacking that main point. And he has 2 main things. The first one is that there's a need for humanity to be reconciled, that something has separated us. There's a need. Despite the fact that God made himself knowable through his creation, humanity chose to worship the things that God made instead of God. And God's response to that choice was to give them over to the natural consequences of that choice. Now, nobody's checking your spelling, so don't worry about big words. So even though God made himself knowable through creation, humanity chose to worship the things God made instead of God. And the result of that was humanity being turned over to the natural consequences of those choices. Even the Jews, who were given special knowledge of God and of his ways through the law, in Hebrew the Torah, the law, even they failed to be faithful to God. They replaced God with God's law, mistakenly believing that faithfulness to God's law was required rather than faithfulness to God. So not only all of humanity who chose to worship the things God made instead of God, but even the Jews who should have known better, who'd been given all this special knowledge, they chose to be faithful to God's law instead of the God who gave the law. Ultimately, the natural consequences of humanity's failure to honor God are sin and death. So that's the state of affairs with humanity. The second point is that God's faithfulness to his promise to, and you've written this already once before, reconcile all creation to himself. You have to write that really small again, or just ditto blank one. You could write that in there as well. God's faithfulness to his promise to reconcile all creation to himself through Israel, despite the fact that all humanity is equally undeserving, has now been revealed in the gospel. So what is the gospel? There's 2 parts to it. Jesus' death makes us right with God. And therefore, we are no longer condemned to live under God's wrath. And God's wrath is equally defined as natural consequences of our choices and God's judgment. Two parts to that. So the first part of the gospel is Jesus' death, which makes us right with God. The second part of the gospel is Jesus' resurrection that saves us from death and that ensures that even when these bodies die, we continue to live. The gospel has two parts, Jesus' death and Jesus' resurrection. The power of the gospel is not the story itself, but the response it elicits in its hearers. The story itself is lovely, but it's the fact that we respond to it that gives it power, a response of faith. And that faith inspires us to trade allegiances from one master, sin. Wave at me if I'm going too fast here. I don't know how fast you write. So the power of the gospel is not the story itself, but the response it elicits in its hearers, a response of faith. That faith inspires us to trade allegiance from one master, who is sin, to another, God. And when sin is our master, we are slaves. When God is our master, we are children. And then we moved into chapter 9, where the question was asked, what about Israel? What do we do with Israel? And here's the summary. Israel, for the most part, has rejected the gospel. Instead of choosing to trust in Jesus' death to make them right with God, they chose to continue to trust in the law. And more particularly, in their commitment to the law to make them right with God. However, Israel's rejection of the gospel is not, write that in capital letters, it is not a sign that the gospel has failed. Throughout Israel's history, over and over and over and over and over again, her people have done three things. They have rejected God. And then following that rejection, they've suffered the consequences of that rejection. And then always the third part of that cycle is, after a time, been reconciled with God. So over and over again throughout Israel's history, the whole Old Testament is these stories. They reject God, they suffer the consequences, and then they are reconciled to God. God always has room for Israel to return. And Paul is saying that this time is no different. The point for Paul's Gentile readers is this, all the non-Jewish readers is this. He tells us, don't ever forget that it is by the grace of God that you've been welcomed into God's family. Further, don't forget that God's family is rooted in Israel. You have not replaced Israel. You are not superior to Israel. Instead, by the grace and the power of God, you have been grafted into Israel. I almost wanted to bring you all donuts as a celebration that we've come to the end of chapters 9 to 11, because I started it by saying these are like the hardest chapters in all of Romans and possibly in all of Paul's writings. And some of you like have come back. And that's great. There's one verse that I want to focus on out of that whole reading, and I have it. Sean, maybe you can pull it up on the screen. It's Romans 11:11, and it comes down to being the summary of how Paul makes sense of Israel and what's going on with all of this. And this is what he writes. He writes in the NRSV version, through their stumbling, meaning through the Jewish people, through Israel's stumbling, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. So we wrestle with this idea of how could it be that God could harden the hearts of Israel or allow them to reject and be put outside while the Gentiles are brought in. And Paul thinks about that and he wrestles with that. And he says, through their stumbling, salvation has come to the Gentiles. That's the first most important thing. That if Israel hadn't stumbled, if Israel hadn't rejected Jesus, Jesus wouldn't have been crucified to start with. So that was kind of important that Israel come against Jesus so that Jesus could be crucified, because it is through Jesus' crucifixion and through his death that we're made right with God. There had to be a sacrifice. And so through their stumbling, we have been made right with God. It's an extraordinary thing. Salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. And that's the phrase that I have been mulling over really for more than a week, probably for all the weeks that we've been looking at verses, at chapters 9 to 11. Gentile salvation is intended to make Israel jealous. Do people look at Christians and get jealous of what we have? That's the real question I've been wrestling with. Because essentially what Paul is saying is the Jewish people, the Israel people, they're going to be looking at all of you Christians and going, you've got everything. Everything that we were promised, everything that we wanted, our whole lives, everything that we read in the Torah that's supposed to be ours, favor with God, blessing from God, all of these great riches from God, that we are God's chosen people, pulled out from everybody else. And they know that this is all theirs. And Paul's saying, they're going to look at you Christians, they're going to see everything that you have, and they're going to go, we want that. And because we want it so desperately, we are going to turn our lives over to Christ. We are going to have faith, not in God's law, but in God who gave the law, which is seen through Jesus. We're going to claim his death as what makes us right. We're going to come back in. I love the picture and the message of the, well, and it's in the NRSV as well, but where the door opened out. It's like the people of Israel got so mad at what was being done that they stormed out of the room like a teenager just storms out and flings the door wide open. And what they didn't realize was that then all the Gentiles went walking in there. And now they're on the outside looking in going, hey, wait a second. We want back in. We want to have some fun because it's so great, everything that's happening in there. And so that'll be enough to attract them in. Isn't that fantastic? Except then I go, do people look at us and get jealous of what we have? So jealous, they'll give up everything. When Tamil was here at the beginning of January and she preached, man, what a gifted preacher she is. This is one of her sentences. She said to this congregation, when people get a glimpse of the kingdom of God, they'll give up anything and everything to attain it, to experience it, to access it. When people just get a tiny little glimpse of the kingdom of God, they'll give up everything. They'll sell everything. The idea of there being a treasure in the field, and you go out and you sell everything to get what it is. Do people look at our lives? Do people look at us and want what we have so bad? They'll give up everything to get it. So that's what I've been mulling on this week. And then my brain went, well, what do we have? And I sat with that question for a long time. What is it that we have? What do we have that's so great? People will get jealous enough to want it for themselves. Really, what do we have? We were, some of the leadership of this church was at a conference this weekend, and they were challenged with the question, when people look at the way that you live your life, what does it say about who God is? And one of the things, Cam, the speaker, he told a story about a guy, a Christian guy, who had a conversation with his neighbor, who said to him, you know, I see how busy you are in life. I see that your schedule is as chaotic and as crazy as mine. Why would I want what you have? All that means is I have to try and find room to add in all the church stuff as well. Ugh. Is that what people see when they look at us? Is that something to be jealous of? Oh, you're even busier than I am because you've got to fit church in there. Oh. When they look at us, what do they see? Something that makes them jealous? But we have something extraordinary. I mean, at the very basic, at the very face of it, every one of us in this church who's made the commitment of faith, who said, Jesus Christ, I know that your death made me right with you, and I know that your resurrection guarantees my resurrection. Every single one of us can face our own deaths strong and optimistic. I mean, not that we're sitting here going, oh, I can't wait to die. Not that we aren't, when you get a death sentence, that you're not grieving, that you're leaving people behind. It's not that. But it's the case of, you know that deep down, when you die, that's not the end. That all the bits and pieces that are broken or wrong or sick or diseased inside of you are going to be wiped clean. You're finally going to be everything you were meant to be. And you're going to get to be that in heaven for all of eternity with Jesus and God and Moses and Elijah and Grandma Jones and whoever else you're going to meet up there. That's something that we have. If you don't have that kind of faith in your life, your facing death is a completely different experience. When you sit in a funeral of one of the saints of the church who's lived their lives as a faithful follower, there's a big difference. There's this celebration, isn't there? We praise God. Muriel Ilton, we buried her not so long ago, and we know that all of her sorrows of this life are over, and we know that she is in heaven. And that's a marvelous, incredible, great witness. As we lie on our deathbeds, we witness to other people, and maybe they will be jealous of what we have. I got thinking about how many people in this church have been fighting horrible illnesses over the last while. A lot of cancer everywhere you look. And I think about the difference that we Christians have when we face our illness compared to those who don't have that kind of faith. Because here's the thing, we don't want to die again. We don't want to suffer the pain. We don't want to go through the pain of the treatments. That's the thing with cancer, isn't it? Those of you who've been through it, you know the treatment's almost worse than the cancer. You don't want to go through all of that. But you cling to the knowledge that God has got you. You know that God's got you in his hands. And as horrible as things are, God's not going to drop you. And even if your illness leads to death, that's okay, because God will still have you in your hands. You're still going to be okay. What a difference that makes when you are enduring the horrible sufferings that this world throws upon you as a Christian who knows deep inside of yourself that you've been made right with God, that it's nothing to do with anything that you've done. God just loves you that much. You're his kid. He's never going to abandon you. Wow. Do other people look at you? I mean, they're not jealous of the cancer. They're not jealous of whatever it is that's going on in your life. But maybe they will be jealous of the incredible hope that you have in the midst of it. That you can cling to the knowledge that you are loved by God. We live in a society that is constantly hammering us away with messages that we are nothing, that we are worthless. We saw a great video at the conference yesterday that essentially pointed to the fact that every time we turn on the television, every time a commercial comes on, it is... commercials are all about telling us how worthless we are and how we will be better if we have stuff. And if you go buy our our DVD, you'll be a better person. And if you go and buy these shoes, like, you'll have more worth in the world. And whatever it is, right? Commercials, we're hammered with it all day long, that we aren't worth anything. Some have had the unfortunate life where you've also been hammered away from parents or from brothers and sisters or from teachers or from other people in your lives who've hammered it away that you are worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless. It's no different in the church than it is out of the church. The difference here is that when you know that you are a child of God, when you said, I'm not going to be a slave to sin anymore, I'm going to be a child of God. I have faith that Jesus Christ made me right, not because of anything I did, even despite the fact that I still keep messing up and I still feel broken and I'm still just not quite all there. Somehow I'm a beloved child of God and my identity is just that. I don't need a whole bunch of stuff to make me worth anything. I don't need to be brilliant. I don't need to be anything but just in God's hands, because just me, loved by God, is an extraordinary thing. Do people look at you and go, wow, how does he just walk around with everything that beats down on him? How is it that he can walk around knowing that he's okay, knowing that he's a good guy? Or how does she keep going despite everything that's been thrown on her, knowing that she's got worth and dignity? Where does that come from? I want that because I don't have that in my life. I want that. It comes because you know that you are a child of God. And if you've forgotten that, you need to remember that. This is what our faith is all about. It's about this extraordinary hope. It's about all of these things that when people look at us, make them jealous. Yeah, we live in a world that is so, the pace of our lives is so frenetic. But as Christians, and I'm aware that some of what I'm saying sounds like the ideal and you might all roll your eyes, but as Christians, we have a different pace that we live our lives at. Because we know that it's not what we do that matters. That's not where our identity is. In fact, we know that it's not what we do that guarantees anything for us. Everything that we have comes by the grace of God. It all belongs to God. And when you know that, when you know that everything that you have comes from God, and that you get to join him in what he's doing, and you get to participate in it all, but it's not up to you. When you know all of that, and you have confidence that it comes from God, it belongs to God, and you're partnering with him, you're a steward of what he's given, then you don't feel like you have to work 80 hours a week. Because you know somehow God's got you covered. Now, it doesn't mean you sit at home on the easy chair and you just lay back and you, God's got it covered, I don't have anything to do. That's not Jesus. That's pure and simple laziness. That's still being a slave to sin. That's not being a child of God, because God has given us work. God has given us things to do with our time. But we Christians, we don't get all mixed up in thinking that it's about everything that we do, because we know it's everything that God does. And so what does that do? That allows us to take a Sabbath. Oh, the Sabbath. You know, that's the most often repeated commandment in the entire Old Testament. And you know what God's punishment is for not keeping the Sabbath? I'm sure I've told you this before. It's death. If you don't keep the Sabbath, you will die. And I don't think that's God saying, you got to do what I say or I'm going to kill you. I don't think that's what God's saying. I think he's saying, if you don't have a rhythm of rest and celebration of me in your life, it's going to kill you. And it is killing us. It's killing the world out there. It's killing people in here. Because we don't have a rhythm of rest. What the Sabbath does is it reminds us that we are dependent on God. As Christians, we know we're dependent on God. We know we're his kids, and he gives us, he showers us with the things that we need. It's not about us going out and taking care of ourselves. God takes care of us. We know that. Imagine how jealous people would be if they knew that you had an entire day every single week where you could just enjoy your family, enjoy the world around you, where you weren't running around like crazy, where you could just sit back and relax. Imagine what people, oh, women, imagine how jealous, I know that's stereotypical, but I know you women in this church, and imagine how jealous the world would be if they knew that you went an entire day without doing your dishes. That's the Sabbath. It's, you know, God saying, you know, take a break. Remember that I'm God and you're not. Yeah, it's a discipline. Yeah, it's hard. How jealous would the world be? Wouldn't they want that? Wouldn't they look in and go, oh, I want that. How do they find time to take time off? Well, they know it's not all dependent on them. It's all dependent on God. We have something extraordinary, and I think that we forget that sometimes. I think we get so caught up in church being one more thing that we do. We forget the whole reason that Paul broke into these extraordinary words of praise, this doxology, is because as he's writing, and I mean, we don't get it in English, but I picture as Paul's writing, he's getting more and more excited because he's seeing this window of how God's been working. He's essentially saying, okay, you know, we got this crazy dilemma. We have, here we have the people of Israel, and suddenly God's hardened. They're his chosen people. They've always been in. And suddenly God's hardened their heart, so now they're out, and everybody else is in. What's up with that? And Paul, in his brilliance and in his faith and his discernment of what God's been doing, he starts to get a glimpse into it, and he goes, oh, I get it. Because it's only when you're outside that you need mercy. It's only outside that you need to experience that incredible grace of God. And it's that incredible experience of the grace of God that leads us to faith. And so now that they're out, and they're going to be peering in through the windows and peering in through the doors, and they're going to see what's going on with all of you, they're going to be so jealous. How can we get back in? God, in your mercy, give us the gift of faith so that we can get back in too. That's what should be happening. I remember years ago having this picture in my head of a church building and people worshiping inside of all walks of life and people peering in through the windows and the doors because they want what we have. Because as much as we feel like there's holes in us, those who don't have Christ have way bigger holes, and they're so much more aware of everything that's broken. We have something extraordinary. Let's live like it. We have hope. We have joy because we know God's got it. We can have confidence. We can have assurance, whatever comes our way. That's what we have. And that's why Paul wrote all the letters that he wrote, because he was so transformed by what he had. And people so quickly, even in the first century, people so quickly, it just became blah. And he kept writing to remind them that this is extraordinary. He took 8 whole chapters to tell them what the gospel was. Why? Because it's such an extraordinary thing what God did for us. If we could just grab on to that again. If people would in the places where we work and in the places we go to school and in the places where we grocery shop, wherever we are, if people got a glimpse of the kingdom of God in us, how jealous would they be and how much would they want that for themselves? Because what we have is extraordinary.